Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
We should now have seen enough of the damage of what it means to return to a no-union capitalism. We are talking about going back to Charles Dickens' condition.
That's the voice of author and economist Robin Hennell. On this week's edition of Latin Waves, we speak to Robin about the ongoing class war in Wisconsin and what we need to be doing as workers to fight back.
Coming up is my guest, Robin Hennell. He is the author of Green Economics and an economist who sees the world slightly different from what is commonly defined by those embedded in the production of corporate imperialism. Welcome to our show, Robin.
Great to be on with you, Sylvia.
Thank you for joining us. Now, the news of Wisconsin are very resonant for us in Canada because as we see a government, the newly recently elected, only 6 weeks in power, the Republican senator decides to pass an anti-union legislation that without even the participation of the full Senate, they even changed the quorum so they could pass it. Why is it the government's imposed laws that prevent workers from negotiating a livable wage while at the same time they give trillions of dollars to the banks? Does this make sense to you from an economist perspective?
No, this is not good economics. This really isn't about economics at all. This is about priorities, and it's part of an increasingly aggressive campaign, not only here in the United States, but in most of the advanced economies throughout the world, of the large corporations who've become increasingly dominant. They're basically imposing their priorities on global capitalism. And in the state of Wisconsin, what we see in the United States is where the one-sided class war became so aggressive and so naked and so visible that people are beginning to fight back. But it's not only going on in Wisconsin. Very, very similar legislation by Republican state legislatures in Indiana, in Ohio, in Rhode Island, in New Jersey. So this is the game plan of the Republican Party in the United States as they take over state legislatures and as they take over governorships. And we're beginning to see the building of a reaction against this. But it's really the same phenomenon. I mean, remember back when the French workers and students, you know, were objecting to the austerity programs back a year and a half ago. The same thing's been happening in Greece. The same thing's been happening in the United Kingdom. The focal point right now here in the United States, and hopefully the sort of catalyst that will help all of us in every state of the country where state governments are saying, we're broke and this is how we are going to solve our problem. We're going to solve our problem by continuing to give tax breaks to the corporations and the wealthy, which is what the governor of Wisconsin did. Just prior to introducing this bill, they passed a bill with brand new tax cuts for corporations in Wisconsin. So to say that we're broke, the budget is broke, right after you've passed more new tax cuts, it's a very obvious sign that this is all about spending priorities. It's not about some sort of economic dilemma that we all have to suffer if we're going to get out of.
Now, the very important point you make there is how, on one hand, we have enough money to give tax cuts to the rich, but we don't have enough money to ensure we have proper education, we have proper health care. So talk a little bit about
this. I hope your listenership has had a chance to either read or hear Michael Moore's talk that he gave in Wisconsin this week. It was really vintage Michael Moore. It was Michael Moore at his best. his opening line in his talk that, you know, that he gave in Madison this week was, America is not broke. And that is so true. And as soon as people accept the starting premise that somehow we're broke, and therefore there is no alternative but to decertify unions that basically protect public employees' pensions and working conditions and wages and health benefits. The bill that they now will pass, they do need the Democrats to come back to the Senate in Wisconsin before they can pass a bill that has to do with fiscal priorities. They were able to decertify the unions because they took it out of the bill that had something to do with fiscal, and that allowed them not to operate without a quorum. But the Republicans in the state legislature of Wisconsin, they have enough votes as soon as they have a quorum, as soon as there are Democrats sitting in the chamber, to go ahead and pass their original piece of legislation. That piece of legislation was cutting back on pensions. It was cutting back on, we have a provision that's in our tax code that basically says if you're absolutely very, very poor, then you don't have to pay any taxes at all, and you can actually get a kind of a refund. They are basically cutting all that out. They're cutting out Medicare. So it is a complete defunding of social priorities. That's, in fact, what's going on. What people need to understand is that the economy of Wisconsin is just as productive as it was last year. As a matter of fact, it's more productive. The productive potential of our economies in the United States, in Canada, in Europe, are greater than they've ever been before. So the question people need to ask is, well, then why cannot we live better? Why must we be told that we have to tighten our belts and live worse? And the answer is basically priorities. I mean, the productivity of the American economy has increased fivefold over the last 50 years. That means we are potentially five times more wealthy than we were 50 years ago. And yet they're telling us that we cannot even enjoy the level of Social Security benefits and Medicare benefits that apparently we were able to afford 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. The secret is this. It's a question of what do we do with our productivity? And you can break it into three major categories. When we get more productive, one thing we can do, and from an environmental point of view, the thing that we most should prioritize is we should take more leisure. And more leisure means retiring earlier. So we should take more leisure when we become more productive. We have a system that basically does not permit that to happen. In terms of consumption, we either can engage in collective consumption or private consumption. If you cut taxes and therefore say there's not enough money in government budgets to pay for collective consumption, things like healthcare, things like education systems, things like infrastructures, then what you're saying is, oh, we're going to take our productivity in the form of private consumption rather than public consumption. Well, market economies are biased in that way. And what we now have is an extreme case of cutting taxes in order to push the entire economy in the direction of engaging in private consumption at the expense of public consumption, even if it means that basic economic infrastructure that's necessary to increase productivity in the future is allowed to essentially deteriorate. Within private consumption, we could consume for necessities or we could consume luxury. And if income has been distributed in the direction of the wealthy, then of course what we're going to have is we're going to have more private consumption of luxuries for the wealthy, and that is the fundamental reason that governments, state governments and national governments are claiming we're broke and we have to take more of consumption possibilities in the form of now pensions and retirement away from working class people simply because the rich have managed to gobble up an increasing share of the productivity of the rest of us.
And that's important. I wanted to point out that, you know, while neoliberal policies particularly impacted countries in Latin America in a significant way, we talk about crisis in food. In poor countries, when they're hit hard, because they're obviously more vulnerable, made this way by economic structures that prevent their actual development, a significant cut in calories means, you know, increase in death in youth and children. You know, if you starve from a diet diet of 3,000 calories a day, well, you can still go on 2,000 calories a day. So, you know, we can cut a little bit. But if you're already starting from 2,000 calories a day, when you drop it to 1,000, you're not even meeting the basic necessities for health. I wonder if you could compare how neoliberal policies have impacted the lives in the rich countries, in the developed countries. Because normally when we talk about inequality here, people say, well, look at Tanzania. Well, look at El Salvador. Look elsewhere. Things are so much worse there. If you don't like it here, go there. How would you answer that?
The neoliberal policies basically have the same effect when you apply them to a third world, less developed economy as they do to a first world economy. They basically shift income and wealth to the very wealthy, and they take spending priorities away from necessities and the kinds of programs that ordinary people need. The only difference is that because their economies are less productive, I mean, it's a long story why those economies are less productive and whether or not first colonialism and then imperialism played a huge role in doing that, and of course that's all true. But at this point in time, the lesser developed economies, when you subject them to neoliberal economic shock, then what happens is you actually drive hundreds of millions of people down below the minimal caloric intake level that's required to simply maintain life. When the IMF comes in and says that government is broke, it can no longer afford to spend on a malaria eradication programs. You can count the number of increased deaths from malaria that kind of prioritization has. The only difference in the advanced economies is what they are doing now is they are basically saying all those of you who, through a period of about 40 years in the middle of the 20th century, managed to climb out of poverty into middle-class status, we can't afford for you to have middle-class status anymore. You can't retire at the age of 65. You can't have, you know, a pension that allows you to live with a little bit of dignity. So it's really just a question of degree. In the advanced economies where the productivity is higher, when you take away from those at the bottom and you take away from those who are sort of middle bottom, then it's still not starvation, but it's loss of dignity. It's a loss of my child will live better than I was able to. That's what they're taking away in Europe. That's what they're taking away in Canada and the United States. In the third world, they were taking away people's lives. They were basically saying, you're going to get malaria and nothing's going to be done about it. You're not going to get enough food to eat. In the third world, they have been suffering this decades longer than we have, and therefore the fight back against it began longer ago. And you see parts of the world, now most recently the Arab world and Latin America prior to that, you see parts of the third world essentially saying no to those neoliberal policies and developing new alternatives that are more people-oriented and also much more protective of the environment. We now are going to go through that political transition where we have to learn how to fight to keep them from taking away what it is that basically people through unions and civil rights campaigns and environmental organizations fought for decades to win. They are basically trying to roll all that back. And so far, they're winning.
I want to talk a little bit about productivity, because when we talk about countries in the South, in the global South, not North America or Europe, as not being as productive and therefore they're doomed to live in misery and suffer hunger, I want to specify what we mean by that, because it is my position that the Latin American countries have not been allowed to have the development that they need. And so to me, development means meeting the needs of people locally in that area. To me, productivity, it's a word that doesn't really become essential. For me, it's more about being efficient about the way we meet those needs. And if we meet those needs, then the country as a whole thrives and develops. So what are some of the barriers then? Because I want to make sure that we don't create this sort of narrative that in the West we have this rich lifestyle because we own it. We earn it. It's ours. And we ignore how we have exploited and extorted other countries, plunder essentially other countries to create this level of comfort that we enjoy here.
The advanced economies are more advanced than the less advanced economies because we have more and better machinery, equipment, technologies per worker than they do. we probably also, on average, although this is changing dramatically in the past 20 years, we probably have a level of education of the workforce that is also higher on average. Now, why did that happen? Well, to some extent, that happened because development began earlier. To some extent, it happened because economic development was thwarted, perverted, and prevented from occurring through colonial regimes. And it's basically been prevented through the imposition of neoliberal policies that, for instance, basically impose on a third world country a model that says that you are going to change your agricultural system away from providing corn, beans, and foods that your people need to eat, and instead you're going to produce export-oriented agriculture for markets back in the first world. And at the same time, you are going to pay more and more to import manufactured goods from us. That was the model that was imposed on the entire third world by first colonialism and then imperialism and its aftermath. And that therein lies, you know, the major part of the explanation for why at this point in time are there differences in productivity. But look, every economy wants to be more productive. There's nothing wrong with productivity. Productivity means the higher our productivity, the less time we need to spend working in things that are less pleasant than leisure to produce the things that are useful and good. That's what productivity is. To some extent, the development level in the first world is partly because we basically raped the third world, and that's where that extra capital and productivity came from. And in part, what we did was we imposed upon them a subsidiary status in the world economy that essentially consigned them to a system that was not going to be capable of developing its own productivity as quickly as it would have been able to otherwise. But what neoliberalism is doing now is taking middle-class status away from people in the advanced economies, and it's further impoverishing and literally killing people in the underdeveloped world, in the lesser developed world.
What are some of the solutions then, the policies that we need to implement locally here? Instead of looking down and comparing and participating in this race to the bottom, how do we create policies that not only ensure we have the minimum requirements for health, education, and create a life with dignity here in Canada, where we are, or in the U.S.?
A good part of the answer is not rocket science, because all we have to do is go back to doing some things that we pretty much knew how to do before. There's a great difference between neoliberal capitalism and social democratic capitalism. In Canada, the word social democrat actually means something. In the United States, I can't use that word because nobody understands what it is. We never had a political party or a movement that called itself social democratic. But what social democracy was in the world, no matter what name it took, was basically a taming of capitalism to make it less inefficient and less unfair and less environmentally destructive. The only time that capitalism has generated a substantial portion of the population that had a middle-class living standard was during the middle of the 20th century, and only in those capitalist economies where you had social democratic policies. What are they? Well, without unions, you're not going to get wages that sustain a middle class. So you need unions, and you need the rights of unions, and you need the government protect the bargaining rights of unions. You need minimum wage laws. You need active government intervention through fiscal policy and monetary policy to prevent recessions and to promote full employment. And when you promote full employment, that also puts upward pressure on wage rates and helps us get the income into the hands of the people that can best use it. You also need intelligent industrial policies. You can't have the financial system basically determining where it is that savings will be invested. Because what we've seen over the past 30 years is that the free financial system, Wall Street, has basically directed the savings of the American economy into one bubble after another, a stock market bubble, a housing market bubble. That is not increasing the productivity of the economy. So you have to have active government intervention in steering investment into the areas that actually enhance productivity. These are policies that were pursued in the 1940s, in the 1950s, the 1960s, into the 1970s in Europe. They were pursued to a lesser extent, but to some extent here in the United States. I think Canada fell someplace between Europe and the United States in terms of how far into a full social democratic agenda, political agenda of policies that you people pursued. We need to win that back. We should now have seen enough of the damage of what it means to return to a no-union capitalism. We are talking about going back to Charles Dickens conditions. That is literally where the Republicans are poised to take us here in this country. We climbed out of Charles Dickens' capitalism tooth and nail through working class struggles and social movement struggles that, you know, that took decades and decades to win reforms. And now those are all being taken away. We have to win those reforms again. And this time we need to win them in a way that says never again. We are not going to allow the conditions to persist where we can have this kind of essentially a right-wing counter-revolution. This is a very radical, you know, reworking of capitalism in the advanced world. It's a very radical campaign, and it's basically poised to take us back to pre-union days and the kind of conditions that Charles Dickens described in his novels.
Thank you so much for being with us. That is so important to remember. That's part of the problem, right? With education, we are told only the parts that reinforce privilege and re-entrench privilege and recreate forms of domination, instead of creating or informing us of the struggles we've fought, where we've had to collaborate, where we've had to work together to bring down that power that subjugates us, that qualifies us, quantifies us, and gives us a number and says, that's what you're determined to do. That's your life. But you're saying we can do different. Your book, Green Economics, Confronting the Ecological Crisis, talks about the imminent threat of constant pollution. What do you hope people will get from reading your book, and how can people access it?
Well, what I'm hoping is that it will clear up some confusions that progressives have when trying to think through not really the causes of climate change. People understand the causes of climate change, but it's very difficult to wrap your mind around sort of different proposals about how it is that we, you know, can best go about averting climate change. And there's a lot of confusion on that subject, and I think that's the thing I had the greatest hope, that I could try and sort of make clear what would work and what wouldn't work. I essentially wanted to focus people's, you know, attention on the prize. The prize is, we need international treaties and we need domestic policies that accomplish three things. They need to be effective, and effective is very simple in this case. We need to bring down global emissions of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases. We need to bring them down by 80 to 90% globally by the middle of the century, or else we're in deep trouble. So the policies need to be effective. The policies also need to be fair. There's going to be costs associated with doing that, and they have to be distributed in a fair way. They have to be distributed fairly between the advanced countries and the less advanced countries, and they have to be distributed fairly in terms of inside countries. Some policies will go ahead and raise the price of carbon, but they will make lower-income people's fuel bills go through the roof. Well, there are ways to do it differently. But, of course, those aren't the ways that you're going to hear coming from the fossil fuel industry or the economic think tanks that basically represent the, you know, the interests of the wealthy. So that was what I was trying to accomplish in the book, trying to provide environmentalists and progressive-minded people who understand this is a serious problem with the tools and the clarity that they need so that they know what sort of policies to fight for and why to fight for those policies rather than accept policies that are either not going to be effective or they're not going to be fair. The other thing that's important for people to understand is we're in a great recession still. No government yet is doing the kinds of things that are going to be necessary to pull us out of this. As things stand, we are going to continue to have very high unemployment rates in the advanced economies. Only way to come out of this is to have something that Van Jones here in the United States, who was originally part of the Obama administration, but was targeted by the right-wing media, and Obama basically forced him to resign. A guy named Van Jones came up with the sort of phrase, a Green New Deal, and what we need are green-collar jobs. The truth of the matter is there is no way to get out of the recession without mammoth government spending on sort of new programs. And this time, the new programs, in order to solve the climate crisis, need to be retrofitting buildings and making them more energy efficient, and starting to build those new non-fossil fuel-based energy components to our energy system, like solar and like wind, etc. So there really is one answer to both of the crises that continues to simply fester and get worse and worse, both the economic crisis and the unemployment, and the fact that we are literally fiddling as Nero did while the planet will end up boiling itself to death because of our carbon emissions. And the solution to both problems is to launch a mammoth Green New Deal, something that was on the order of magnitude of converting our economies to win World War II. We need to have that kind of a massive mobilization. But you need to have a movement powerful enough to push the political system into doing that, because it is not headed in that direction. The corporations and the wealthy elite are doing everything in their power to basically, prevent us from going down that path. And if we don't go down that path, we are basically going to have permanently depressed economies, and we are going to have serious, serious environmental damage that just increases over the next few decades.
Thank you again for being with us.
It was great being with you again.
Take care.
I'm going to play you a couple minutes of Michael Moore's recent speech in Madison, Wisconsin. I highly recommend you go and watch it on YouTube. You can search it out under We're Not Broke. And we're not, so don't let politicians tell you need to take rollbacks or cuts in vital services. Tell them they need to make better priorities with our money. Take care for now.
Contrary to what those in power would like you to believe, so that you'll give up your pension, cut your wages, and settle for the life your great-grandparents had, America is not broke. Not by a long shot. The country is awash in wealth and cash. It's just that it's not in your hands. It has been transferred in the greatest heist in history from the workers and consumers to the banks and the portfolios of the uber rich. Right now, this afternoon, just 400 Americans, 400, have more wealth than half of all Americans combined. Let me say that again. And please, someone in the mainstream media, just repeat this fact once. We're not greedy. We'll be happy to hear it just once. 400 obscenely wealthy individuals. 400 little Mubaraks. Most of whom benefited in some way from the multi-trillion dollar taxpayer bailout of 2008. Now have more cash, stock, and property than the assets of 155 million Americans combined.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.